I went by canoe with my guide to explore some distant lakes. We had crossed the divide and fished in waters that had seldom mirrored the face of man, and as we glided along the indented shore, deer feeding in the rushes leapt from the water and disappeared. From the bushes a fox with cunning eyes and upraised foot watched us as we passed. From the deep, the black bay slept, and down in the clear waters the musk lunge swam lazily over the bars. A dinner on the shore among the sturdy pines and hemlocks, the crackling fire, savory bacon and aromatic coffee to satisfy the appetite, made strong with effort, such was yesterday, and returning home as the sun disappeared in the golden west, having taken a plunge in the waters of the lake, I sat down in a great chair on the veranda to rest. Soon the purple twilight came, and with it the silence like the benediction that falls between toil and sleep, and then the psychic hour when one sends his thoughts out into the great beyond. I was weary, and musing on the marvelous experiences that had been mine, my thoughts went out to my own, in the afterlife, and to the many new friends and acquaintances I have made 77, among such people. There was harmony between the eye and brain, the tints between earth and sky become neutral. I looked lazily upon the waters, at the islands and down the long bay, and as I mused, there fell upon my senses music so distant as hardly to be perceptible. Was it music at all? I listened again, it seemed to be in a valley among the hills. I could not believe my senses, it was distinct yet not distinct, it sounded like a great orchestra of string and reed instruments played by master hands, and with it the gentle wind among the trees and all the voices of nature seemed to blend in one great whole. It approached with soft cadence and then receded, passing back into the silence where it was lost. Looking again, I saw that the harvest moon, which had just risen over the trees, made a bright and shining path across the lake, and as I watched the waters play and sparkle in that light I was astonished to see a bridge from the farther shore across the narrow bay leading straight to the point on which my cabin stood. It was as perfect in outline as the one suspended across Niagara's gorge, with the exception that while definite in outline, it was light and almost transparent. The entire structure seemed made of soft, filmy, radiant material, definite yet indefinite. As I watched, I saw someone approaching over the bridge. Soon I beheld the outline of a woman's form, and beside her a young boy, holding her hand. Was this a dream? Startled, I aroused myself, and beads of perspiration came out upon my forehead. I felt the chair and tightened my hold. I looked up and dimly saw the stars and constellations in the sky, and the islands in the lake. I saw again the bridge of light and those who were coming nearer. I shut my eyes, and all the moonlight, the waters, and the islands in the waters were blotted out, all gone but the bridge of light and those who were upon it. I was alone in this great forest. Afraid? One asks. Yes, at first until I appreciated that I saw not with the physical eye, but through my senses. I was looking into the invisible. I had come to know long ago that the dead so-called were my friends, so there was naught to fear, and I waited for their coming. So distinct was the woman that I saw her dress of white flowing garments like the Greeks wore in the days of Pericles, then her face. And as it became visible, I half started to my feet, for it was the smiling face of my mother. I observed her features, and how her hair fell in folds about her ears. Her face was just as in the old days, except that age and the lines of care had disappeared, and as I looked she seemed to know that I had recognized her and had noticed the child. As the two came nearer, a light different from anything I had ever seen shone in the child's face and through his hair. He waved his hand laughing, and still the two came toward me in the path of the moonlight. I realized that I was having an experience entirely new and that it was important to make my observations with great care. I took long deep breaths and waited. My mother and the child reached the point on which the bridge rested and stepped upon the shore, and up the sandy path toward the cabin, so near now that every detail of face and form was visible. And I knew the child was my son, who went out into the afterlife in infancy, but who had now grown to about the age of 5 years. My pulse was beating fast, as my heart pounded under the excitement. I was no longer composed, for all my love and longing for my mother and my son swept over me. I started to my feet and down the steps to meet those who came with laughing eyes and smiling lips, my hands outstretched, but as I touched them, they seemed to dissolve and were gone. I was upon the shore alone, the soft wind stirred the branches. I walked down to the water which was still sparkling in the path of the moonlight, but the bridge was gone, and those who came upon it. This had been no dream, for not for one moment had I slept, nor did sleep come before the dawn crept into the eastern sky. Experiences little less strange come to others. While Mr. W., we will call him, one of the most brilliant lawyers in America, was examining a woman as a witness in the trial of an action some months ago in the courthouse in Buffalo, she gasped, fell back in her chair, and was dead. Mr. W., wholly without imagination and painfully material, told me, and I have not the slightest doubt of his veracity, that when he saw his client gasp and fall back in her chair, he rushed toward her, and as he did so, he saw, and plainly saw, a shadow-like substance having the form and outline of the witness emerge from the body and move away. I cite this fact to show that others have had experiences similar to my own, though perhaps not so perfect in detail. Months have elapsed since I sat upon the veranda about the log cabin in the Canadian wilderness and saw the etheric bridge and two of the inhabitants of the afterlife, but the impression, the memory, will never be dimmed in the years to come. Today it is more distinct than any incident of my life, and now you ask, as I have asked, what was it? At a subsequent time when occasion was presented, I asked a member of our spirit group to give an explanation of what had occurred. In answer he said, I am familiar with the occurrence because I was present. It was an object lesson. We wanted you to see something of the actual conditions prevailing in this afterlife, as you call it, so that you could more clearly describe it, and through you, others could obtain some little appreciation of what waits beyond the physical. Before I answer your question in detail, I want to say again, and it cannot be repeated too often, that the body that you see and touch is but the housing, or garment worn by another body, the etheric or spirit body, which is just as much substance as the flesh, but so refined, intense, and so high in vibration that the physical eye cannot see it or the hand feel it. Now in death, so called, the etheric body leaves the physical housing, ceases to live on the physical plane, and becomes an inhabitant of this plane where everything is etheric, matter simply vibrating more rapidly than such substance as is seen ordinarily by men. We repeat this proposition to you, and you should repeat it to others as often as occasion is presented, because it is entirely new in physics, and so beyond the world's teaching that even with oft-repeated telling it will be found difficult of comprehension. It was with this end in view that great effort was made to give you the demonstration which we did. In further answer to your question, said the member of the spirit group, you must know, that there is no such thing as imagination, as that word is generally used. Your dictionaries define it as the image-making power of the mind, the power to create or reproduce ideally an object previously perceived, the power to call up mental images. There must exist the sun before there can be the shadow, the real must precede the imitation, there must be the original before the copy, the subject before the photograph. One cannot imagine something that has no existence in nature. The imagination must have something basic. The etheric mental lines or waves of the mind ordinarily move at will in and about the unknown land, and through the subconscious brain get impressions and suggestions, usually intangible and indefinite. Such wandering of the mind not being understood, an entirely false conception is obtained of the mental operation. Everything in the universe is real, is material, and the groping of the mind in the mental plane is called imagination, the word itself being derived from image, reflection, the likeness of something else. All this leads up to your personal experience. What you saw actually existed. The bridge was real, and the mother and the little son actually crossed, and came to you as you relate. But you did not see with your physical eye, you were alone in the great forest, and around you all was natural, There was perfect harmony between you and your environment, your thought was passive, and we, coming in close contact with your brain, touched and quickened or rather sensitized your psychic sense, and by that process you saw more surely than would have been possible with the physical eye. It is only on rare occasions that it is given to one without psychic sight fully developed to look into the invisible, and it may never come to you again. The bridge you saw was composed of etheric substance, actual and real, constructed by mental operations, rather than by the hands. The mind can only fashion gross matter into form by use of the hands, but etheric forms may be fashioned and changed by mental operation alone. And those whom you saw were your own, they had bodies, etheric bodies, and they were clothed in etheric garments. As you know, they are not lost, but live and progress in this, the mental sphere, waiting until the period of your development in the physical is completed. Then will come the reunion, the meeting, and, together, life everlasting. When will the mind grasp the proposition that all natural changes planned by the Master Intelligence mean progress? When shall we as a people be able to look upon the last great change understandingly? When shall we become big enough to think of the opportunity given to the one who goes forth, instead of thinking of our temporary loss? If the world would only comprehend that death means living on in more splendid environment, and that those who have gone forth continue to live in a world no less material than this, the burden of sorrow and the awful fear of what is called death would pass from the human heart. Ignorance is the parent of fear. What matters it whether one goes out this year or next? In the afterlife, time does not exist, and progress is eternal. Chapter 20, Power of Suggestion. The inhabitants of this invisible world influence and in some measure control the thought and conduct of every individual. They are more progressive than we, and having no incentive to accumulate money, devote themselves to the acquisition of knowledge. They delve deeply into the forces of nature, and dealing with matter in greater refinement, make from time to time discoveries, some of which are utilized on the physical plane. Faraday, who first made practical the force known as electricity, did not cease his investigations with dissolution, but has been a potent factor in its development through suggestion to those who devote their time to the utilization of that force. Raphael did not cease to portray upon canvas his wonderful creations, nor did Michelangelo lose his ability to chisel marble into forms of beauty when he ceased to inhabit this plane. The years that have elapsed since they went on, have been years of opportunity and progress. Mozart, Beethoven, and all the other musicians who gave us our great compositions, have they gone down into the silent and relentless darkness, or have they continued their work, impressing on others from day to day new music that enriches the world? Milton, Dryden, 80, Pope, Goldsmith, Moore, Wordsworth, Burns, Browning of modern times, Seneca, Pliny the Elder, Plutarch, Epictetus, Tacitus and Cervantes, of an earlier period, were all their wonderful writings and philosophies produced without suggestion from the masterminds in the more advanced spheres. I know this one fact, that people in the afterlife are so close, so in touch with our thoughts that it is difficult for anyone to say that this or that is the product of his own intellect. Progress owes much to the invisible. Robert G. Ingersoll, well known to me in the afterlife, speaking on this subject said, "Let me give the most remarkable illustration of spirit suggestion, the immortal Shakespeare. Neither of his parents could read or write. He grew up in a small village among ignorant people, on the banks of the Avon. There was nothing in the peaceful, quiet landscape on which he looked, nothing in the low hills, the undulating fields, nothing in the lazy flowing stream to excite the imagination. Nothing in his early life calculated to sow the seeds of the subtlest and sublimest thought. There was nothing in his education or lack of education to account for what he did. It is supposed that he attended school in his home village, but of that there is no proof. He went to London when young, and within a few years became interested in Blackfriars Theatre, where he was actor, dramatist, and manager. He was never engaged in a business counted reputable in that day. Socially he occupied a position below servants. The law described him as a sturdy vagabond. He died at 52. How such a man could produce the works which he did has been the wonder of all time. Not satisfied that one with such limited advantages could possibly have written the masterpieces of literature, it has been by some contended that Bacon was the author of all Shakespeare's comedies and tragedies. It is a fact to be noted that in none of this man's plays is there any mention of his contemporaries. He made reference to no king, queen, poet, author, sailor, soldier, statesman, or priest of his own period. He lived in an age of great deeds, in the time of religious wars, in the days of the Armada, the Edict of Nantes, the massacres of Saint Bartholomew, the victory of Lepanto, the assassination of Henry III of France, and the execution of Mary Stuart, yet he did not mention a single incident of his day and time. The brain that conceived time and of Athens was a Greek in the days of Pericles and familiar with the tragedies of that country. The mind that dictated Julius Caesar was an inhabitant of the Eternal City when Caesar led his legions in the field. The author of Lear was a pagan, of Romeo and Juliet, an Italian who knew the ecstasies of love. The author of those plays must have been a physician, for he shows a knowledge of medicine and the symptoms of disease, a musician, for in The Two Gentlemen of Verona he uses every musical term known to his contemporaries. He was a lawyer, for he was acquainted with the forms and expressions used by that profession. He was a botanist because he named nearly all known plants. He was an astronomer and a naturalist and wrote intelligently upon the stars and natural science. He was a sailor, or he could not have written The Tempest. He was a savage and trod the forest's silent depths. He knew all crimes, all regrets, all virtues, and their rewards. He knew the unspoken thoughts, desires and ways of beasts. He lived all lives. His brain was a sea on which the waves touch all the shores of experience. He was the wonder of his time and of ours. Was it possible for any man of his education and experience to conceive the things which he did? All the Shakespearean works were, beyond a doubt, the product of his pen, but the 81 conceptions, the plays, the tragedies were the work of many brains, given Shakespeare by spirit suggestion. He was but the sensitive instrument through which a group of learned and distinguished scholars, inhabitants of many lands when in earth life, gave to posterity the sublime masterpieces of the Bard of Avon. The writings of Swedenborg were produced in the same way. Sade wrote by spirit suggestion, and as a fact many of the best works of so-called great men have been in part the action of the minds of those beyond our earthly plane, who, working in conjunction with man, do something for the uplift of the human race. Knowing as I do the potent influence of spirit people upon the world's thought, and how in every way they seek to enlighten us as to the change called death, I have wondered what spirit impressed this poem on a mortal mind. As the faint dawn crept upwards, grey and dim, he saw her move across the past to him, her eyes as they had looked in long gone years, tender with love, and soft with thoughts of tears, her hands, outstretched as if in wonderment, nestled in his, and rested there, content. Dear wife, he whispered, what glad dream is this? I feel your clasp, your long-remembered kiss, touches my lips, as when you used to creep into my heart, and yet, this is not sleep, is it some vision, that with night will fly? Nay, dear, she answered, it is really I. Dear heart, it is you I know. But I knew not the dead could meet us so, bodied as we are, see, how like we stand. Like, she replied, in form, and face, and hand. Silent a while, he held her to his breast, as if afraid to try the further test, then, speaking quickly, must you go away? Husband, she murmured, neither night nor day. Close to her then, she drew his head, trembling, I do not understand, he said. I thought the spirit world was far apart. Nay, she replied, it is not now, dear heart. Quick, hold fast my hand, lean on me. So, cling to me, dear. 'Tis but a step to go. The white-faced watchers rose, beside the bed, shut out the day, they sighed, our friend is dead. This is a substantial description of what is actually occurring from hour to hour, in the change as the individual catches his breath in the etheric atmosphere, and his vision is clarified as a result of throwing off the flesh tissue. He sees spirit people, like in form and face and hand, so natural, so unlike what one has been led to believe that it is hard to understand. But let us remember that the change is a natural one, that all nature's changes are for our good, planned by the Master Intelligence, in order that our opportunity for development may be increased, and we may grow more godlike. Knowing this, we can meet the dawn of the new conditions with confidence and courage. Man is a part of nature, his intelligence being developed and refined to a greater or less degree. He is an integral portion of that force which we term God. It is not necessary that we bend the knee and worship at any shrine or altar, but knowing that we are part of that intelligent force which holds dominion in nature, it is incumbent upon us to do no act unworthy of our position, to live where the best thoughts grow, day by day to strive to maintain the integrity and standards set for us, and ultimately to do our utmost to increase that force called good, or God. In all ages man has pursued happiness by countless paths and innumerable roads. Some have thought that within the hollow crown that rounds the mortal temples of a king, it kept its seat, some have thought that on the throne it sat and smiled, and have waded through seas of blood to reach it, some have thought that behind the walls of splendor it made its home, others, despairing of finding it there, have pictured a world beyond, where happiness could be found perfect and complete. But let us realize that there is only one royal road which leads to happiness, and that is to practice the plain, old, yet incomparable maxim, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. These sacred words uttered in different form 600 years before the alleged birth of Christ, fell from the lips of the great Confucius, and are today found in nearly every sacred volume of the world. Chapter 21, Never a Secret in the World. There never has been and never can be a secret in this world. This is an entirely new proposition, which, if understood, would prevent much crime and unhappiness, and would enrich all mankind. There has always been an idea that many things can be done secretly, that, for instance, one can lie, and it will never be known, that one can cheat and defraud another, and not be found out, that a thief can enter a home without detection, that immorality can be carried on without society being the wiser. All these wrongs are being done under the belief that they can be accomplished secretly, and most of them are done in this manner so far as our world is concerned. Mankind has been taught that God sees all and knows all, but men and women do not believe it, otherwise crimes would not be committed, and the moral code would not be violated. Pride and the speech of people have a great influence on conduct. Now, suppose the thief knew that if he took the property of another, his act would, beyond peradventure, be exposed in the morning paper, and he would be under immediate arrest. With conviction absolutely certain, would he commit the crime? Suppose the businessman, or captain of finance, knew that if he formed unlawful combinations and defrauded the public, he would certainly be imprisoned. Suppose men and women knew that violations of the moral code would be known and censured within the hour, would wrong and crime go rampant through the land? Men and women do these acts in the belief that they are discreet enough to so cover them, that they will never be known. Such people have little idea that every act, I will go further, everything is known by those in the afterlife who are interested in our welfare. But they are far away, one says. No, they touch elbows and walk beside us day by day. One cannot comprehend God as a personality witnessing each act and knowing the individual thought of over 400 million of people, but one can comprehend the fact that the afterlife is inhabited by those who have passed through the earth life, that they improve their condition by helping those in need of assistance, that by their silent suggestion through the subconscious brain, they try to aid us, keep in touch with our thought, and are silent witnesses of all the wrong in the physical world. I do not mean that all the inhabitants of the afterlife know each wrong act. What I do mean is that every man, woman, or child has loved ones in the afterlife who take a deep interest in his or her welfare, be their position high or low. In other words, the ties of blood, The bonds of love, the interest of friends are not severed by dissolution. As the father, mother, brother, sister, wife, or child, know by experience the awful effect of wrongdoing, and are able to come about us and witness our conduct, note our mental vibrations and so read our thoughts, is it not the most natural thing in the world that they should try to stay our evil acts? If mankind knew this fact, that nothing is ever really done in secret, would wrong be committed at all? Men and women are restrained often by pride. They only stray from the path of rectitude when they think that they go in secret. Teach men the truth, and it will help to make the home sacred, to empty the prisons, it will add more than any other one thing to the sum total of human happiness. Again, the churches teach in substance that though our sins be scarlet, yet we can become as white as snow, and that there is forgiveness for all sin. One sect goes so far as to vest that power in the church. The practical result of such teaching has been and is, to license wrong and crime. Men do wrong under the impression that in some way they will escape the just consequences of their wrongful act. I have said before, and I will say again, that the world is not a jumble, but controlled by law, for every effect there is a cause, and that cause is governed by law. Every act produces a result. Every thought being material creates a condition about us, and is retained in one of the 16 or more million cells of the brain. When, therefore, anyone goes out of this life and enters the etheric where everything, the good and bad, is intensified beyond mind, measure, the storehouse of the brain is opened, and he or she is confronted with the record which has been made. Nothing is forgotten, the good get reward, otherwise courage would be lost, punishment for wrongdoing is terrible beyond words. Everyone must bear his own burden, must meet again every wrongful act and make in ways that are provided complete restitution. This is very difficult, and the way is very long. One who believes that the world of men marks the beginning or the end has no more comprehension of the true situation than the mole, following the path which it has made under the dead grass in the meadow lands, knows of the physical world. I have been told two most important truths by those who have honored me by their teaching, that there never has been and never can be a secret in the world, that man has no savior but himself, and that the wrong which he does, he must undo. Whatever obligations he contracts, he must meet. I have had other teachings that have appealed most strongly to reason. One of these is do no worry, but fit yourself to meet situations from day to day. The obstacles which we meet are of our own creation. The troubles we have are of our own making. If we possessed all wisdom, we would then be gods, and not make mistakes. No one is perfect in this world or has reached full development, and until such time everyone as a result of lack of wisdom and judgment will continue to make mistakes and create obstacles over which he will stumble. But that is not misfortune, mistakes are necessary. And it is only by creating and overcoming them that we gain wisdom, and know how to avoid the same conditions again. They are the stepping stones to the heights of understanding, and are good for us. Let us meet them cheerfully and appreciate the lesson each teaches. Ordinary errors ought not to cause us anxiety, for it is only through them that we make progress. A just and full appreciation of this fact would take from the mind the useless burden of worry. Calamity is nature's spare, trials are not only essential, but are disciplinary, misfortune is opportunity. Other desirable things which I have learned from this unusual source are, we have no right to burden others with our sorrows, all nature is optimistic, all tending toward good, as one thinks, so he is. There are some men so pessimistic that given the choice of two evils, they insist upon taking both. They see no good in anything and are ever looking upon the dark side, anticipating misfortune. The mind is a wonderful force, its influence extending much further than we have any idea of, and one can do very much to make the world happier. On the other hand, one can do much to make others unhappy by throwing upon them one's own mental condition, and many people by force of habit do this, unmindful of the result. I recall not long ago a morning in the springtime. The sun was warm, the air balmy, dandelions bared their velvety bosom to the sky, Tulips and daffodils fringed the borders. The lawns were carpeted with green. Birds had returned from the south and were building nests and singing. It was a morning when a temperament that could not respond to environment was poor indeed.